Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, I speak with Lilka Elbaum, a Polish-Jewish refugee from communist Poland, who is the subject of the new documentary, Still Life in Lutz, that's coming up on Endeavors.
You're listening to Endeavors Radio with your host from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, Dan McPeak.
Well, hi there, and happy Sunday. It's been a minute since I posted a new episode. As listeners probably know, I've been working as a crew on a Netflix series, and because I bounce back and forth between prep and set, my schedule hasn't always been the same, and working 16, 17 hour days hasn't given me a great amount of time to find and conduct interviews. So I might be down to once a week for, you know, for the next few weeks, just until I can sort of wrap my head around my own sanity. But I still plan on producing as much content as I can in that time. And today's show is a very powerful story. When, you know, if you were my age, or, you know, anybody who, you know, really went to school, you know, past the 1960s, you learned about the Holocaust. And at least I remember, you know, knowing what happened to the Jews, the Jewish population in Poland during the time of the Holocaust, predominantly in the city of Warsaw. But at least for me, history didn't teach me what happened after the war in places like Warsaw, Krakow, Lutz. Poland was, at the time, a very Jewish country. But like so many Eastern European countries, it got into communism. And because of that, many Jews were expelled. Lilka Elbaum was one such person who was expelled from Lutz, Poland in 1968, where she fled to Montreal, Canada. She has been back to Poland several times, but most recently, she decided to do so with filmmaker Sławomir Grunberg to make the film Still Life in Lutz. And the reason why it's called Still Life is because one of Lilka's strongest memories of her apartment in Lutz is a still life painting that hung in her apartment. And when they were expelled, they had to leave everything behind. And that painting ended up going to the man who bought all the contents from that apartment. And Lilka knew the family and went to be reunited with the painting and that man's daughter. And the film is a very powerful, a very emotional look at a woman who revisits a time that, by her own admission, was happy, and then all of a sudden was taken away from her. I got to speak with Lilka about the painting, what that painting did for her memory, going back to Lutch, coming to Canada, why we need to know more about post-war Poland and post-war Europe, if she sees any similarities between the Jewish experience and what we're seeing now with Black Lives Matter, with the Indigenous Rights Movement, and the anti-Semitic purge that happened in the late 1960s. The film is Still Life in Lodz, which opens March the 12th. It was directed by Sławomir Grunberg, who has made such documentaries as Karski and The Lords of Humanity. It's a very cinema verite style documentary. And like I said, I got to speak with the subject, Lilka Elbaum. I apologize that this intro wasn't more concise, but I'm going to let Lilka, who is much more eloquent than I am, tell her story. This is my conversation with Lilka Elbaum. Excellent.
I'm going to do this. Oh, yeah. Okay. I can see you. It's so nice to speak with a fellow Canadian. I am Canadian. I mean, I'm a Canadian citizen still.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I have dual citizenship, and I am very, very, sort of emotionally attached to Canada, since this is where I immigrated from Poland. So you are based in Vancouver?
Victoria, actually. So
Victoria, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful, yeah. British Columbia, know Vancouver well.
Yeah, no, I was out in Toronto for a few years, and then... Really? And then came back home during the pandemic last year. So.
Oh, really? Are you planning to go back to Ontario? Or?
Yeah, at some point. I got a few things to do over there, but I might go across the Atlantic to the British Isles at some point. We'll see.
I think it's more exciting, you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
I had a chance to watch this documentary. Right. I'm always curious as to the timing and the reasons why people decide to tell their stories. What was there any one impetus for you that said now is the time I want to do this?
Okay, so essentially, no, I never really thought about doing this. It was purely, it came out from an emotional encounter with an item, the painting, which I came across on one of my many returns to Poland. And I was myself incredibly, surprised that I was so moved by it. It's just an object, an object which reminded me of my home and of my parents, of the family life we had. And then sort of I thought about writing about it and, short story, long story. But then I realized that everything nowadays is visual, or audio. So I thought about, sort of making it as a documentary, but I'm not a filmmaker. So I contacted, first one director in Poland and then subsequently Sławomir Grunberg, who directed the movie. And, it was like 3 years in movie making purgatory. But, I don't know. I felt that from the responses I get from people who see the film and who share my background, you know, of being an immigrant, although I've been in Canada since I came to Canada in 1968. But nevertheless, you know, my roots are in Europe. And also as a Polish Jew, I basically, you know, always carry with me my parents' background as Holocaust survivors. So when we showed the movie and we had a bunch of things scheduled, but the pandemic interfered. At the same time, whenever somebody sees the movie and has similar background, they come to me and they want to do the same thing. They want to know more. They want to go there. Because, you know, we as a group, children of Holocaust survivors, we definitely don't know anything practically about our family. So it was a journey, but it was unexpected and grew out like organically out of my emotional, you know, encounter.
How much did you work with Swava, the director, in terms of, you know, what to include, what not to include, you know, if you're going to tell it, you know, consecutively or you're going to jump around a bit? What were those conversations like?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that. So, you know, I wrote this story and, you know, we had a long period, you know, in pre-production and then the shoot, you know, we shot, you know, we had three shoots in Poland on location, as you know. That's also pretty rare from this perspective. But, you know, Swabek has done a lot of documentaries and he had his own visions. As we went along, you know, new details emerged about our subject matters. So we had to adjust. But I would say it's my story, but the way it's presented, including the animation, which is, you know, Swabek went to the famous film school where Roman Polański went. And, you know, he is a great cinematographer, but he had his own ideas. So I would say that in post-production, I had very little to do with it. He basically, you know, concocted the way the film is constructed based on the story I wrote.
You know, you mentioned this whole thing started when you saw that still life mm-hmm. painting when you went back to Poland. Have you thought about why, you know, something that could be considered, you know, just an insignificant object, why it triggered the reaction that it did for you?
I think my reaction would be pretty common for people of my background. You know, I as you probably gathered from the film, I didn't leave Poland voluntarily. A lot of people, when they realize I am from Poland, they went like, you are so lucky to, you know, leave this country. It was a communist country at the time. And we as a minority, you know, although I have not experienced personally any anti-Semitism until 68, where we became pawns in this political, you know, game. They kind of think that I was lucky that I was able to relocate to beautiful Montreal, went to McGill, you know, went to a career, and everything was kind of really better. But, you know, I lost my home. I basically lost my home. It doesn't matter. It was, which is, it's now sort of going through a very interesting renaissance because it has beautiful architecture. But it was a drab, you know, industrial city in Poland, one of the largest manufacturing center for textiles. And, you know, it was not pretty. I went to London from Poland and I was in beautiful London. But yet, you know, I was happy to go back because this was my home. In other words, I lived there. I had a life there. It was not perfect, but home is something where, you know, I'm sure it's significant to everybody. And once you leave your country, and especially that we were thrown out of Poland, our citizenship was stripped. In other words, my family, as much as I know, lived in Poland for, you know, 200 years. we were actually stripped of our Polish citizen, and only because we were Jews. And we had to leave, you know, we're stateless. We were stateless. So when I came to Canada, you know, I received my landed immigrant status on arrival in Montreal, but then I waited 5 years to become a Canadian citizen. So, you know, I became an immigrant, you know, it doesn't matter. I did well, I didn't do well, but my status has changed. So it is more like a musing, you know, of on life. And if you some people willingly want to leave Poland, but we were forced to leave Poland. So our life was interrupted.
You know, I think at least when I was in high school, you know, growing up, we all learned, you know, what happened with Poland during the war, but, you know, and before the war. But I don't think a lot of people realized what a lot of Eastern Europe went through post-war. You know, there was the rise of communism, but up until 68, would you say that life in post-war Lodz was decent?
For us, it was, you know, it was, we, at that point, you know, we didn't know anything else. So yes, Lodz was considered an ugly city, not as beautiful as Krakow or Warsaw, but it doesn't matter. You know, we had our friends, our family. I had no family. I practically, you know, anybody who survived the Holocaust, you know, came out of it either alone or one or two family members, if they were lucky. But, you know, we had a Jewish community there, which is very interesting because people really don't know about it. You know, they really think that Jewish life in Poland ended with the Holocaust. In other words, 95% of Polish Jews were exterminated, murdered actually, by the Nazis, by German Nazis. But it's not true. You know, the survivors came back and those who wanted to stay, stayed. And we had a life. We had a Jewish school. I went to a school where, you know, the teaching language was Polish, but we also had Yiddish as a language, Yiddish, Jewish history. We had all kinds of after-school activities. I had my friends who were, you know, Jewish and non-Jewish, it doesn't matter. And yes, we had a life. We went on vacations. My parents went abroad. You know, you saw the apartment I lived in. I mean, it is kind of drab. I mean, right now it's empty. It's awaiting some sort of a renovation. But yes, I was aware it was not perfect, but it was not that important. We had a life. Yes, there was a Jewish life in Poland, and there were about 30,000 Jews who lived up to 68. And as a result of this anti-Semitic campaign by the Polish government, I would say about 19,000 left Poland, stateless, their citizenship, and those who remained out of choice, either, you know, they were older or they didn't want to leave, but the majority left. But yes, it was, as I said in the movie, and, you know, it's interesting that you asked this, Dan, because what basically happened when American Jews see this movie, and I start on this rather sad note, this was the end of our life in Poland, as I segue to the same thing I told you before, they said, why are you unhappy about it? I mean, you had a chance to leave an anti-Semitic, horrible country. So, you know, there's a bit of a disconnect. You know, you cannot be a thinking human being and kind of, you know, leave, we're thrown out, come back, and kind of everything gets really better. No, it doesn't work like this. I would say for me it didn't. So, so essentially, yes, we did have a life, and this life was interrupted in 68. And as a matter of fact, I have to say that there is a Jewish life in Poland today, but to me, there was a permanent discontinuity in 68. And what came after, which is today, it is something, but it's different and discontinuity remains. So, Yes, I often am asked this question, you know, why shouldn't you be just doing cartwheels? You know, so I hope I was able to, you know, tell you why not.
You know, one thing I did notice in the film is when you talk about your childhood, you always say there were Jewish kids and there were Polish kids, and you know, and that they were separate. Mm-hmm. And now you, it seems you identify as a Polish Jew. Is there still a distinction for you between Jewish and Poles? Has it come a little more full circle for you?
Well, you know, interesting that you ask this. Actually, you know, this saying Poles and Jews is not a correct way, because we were also Poles. So there were Christian Pole, you know, like Judaism is a religion. So essentially, often it says Poles and Jews, Jews being the other, you know, the minority. But it's not correct. We were Polish Jews. In other words, I don't know if you are aware, but 85% of Jews worldwide can trace their provenance to Poland. Poland was the largest country in the world, you know, with Jewish population. Even on the eve of World War II, there were 3.3 million Jews in Poland, 10% of the population. And Łódź was the third largest Jewish city in the world. You know, first, you know, it switched at the beginning of the century. You know, it was New York, then Warsaw, and then Łódź, or Łódź, you know, as they pronounce it here. But essentially, yes, it's completely, this is a distinction which is more cultivated by in Poland. I have to say that nowadays in Poland, there's a similar situation to United States. You know, I kind of remember, you know, Canadian politics as being like really mild and, you know, tempest in the teapot kind of thing. And the government was something which existed, but, you know, it was like, okay, well, doesn't matter. But since I lived in the United States for 25 years, you know, I mean, it's incredibly pervasive and intrigued, you know, I became like really engaged in politics. So we now have a new government, and in Poland, you know, there's a right-wing government, very openly anti anybody, you know, LGBT, Jews, very similar to the kind of platform which we had in the United States until very recently, and anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, anti-Catholic. In other words, you know, even if you are a Christian, but you are not a Catholic, you are not considered, you know, sort of a number one. So essentially, they really cultivate this Jews and Poles, but it's not correct because we are Polish, and I did get back my Polish citizenship with apologies, and I have three citizenship right now, which is really unique. I have three passports, US, Canadian, and EU, but essentially it's we were Polish, and I had many Polish friends, and you know, if you've seen from the film, I can never be, I would say that, you know, American Jews, Canadian, and here in the US, there is a negative attitude toward Poland overall, you know, because people associate Poland, you know, like with the Holocaust and what happened there. And, you know, it's unfair to a degree because, you know, this whole thing was concocted by Germany. And yes, the six extermination camps were what was then territory of Poland, because Poland was partitioned, it didn't exist during the war. But I personally have an incredible thing happened that my mother was saved by Polish Christians. And as you see in the movie, I maintain a relationship to this day. This is already the fourth generation. And to me, this kind of obliterates, perhaps it is not really the right way to look at it. But, you know, the fact that my mother was saved by Polish Christians, she was a stranger to them. You know, it was for some reason they decided to help her, but this could have had horrible consequences for them. They could have been murdered if they were found out. And when I asked them, one of the, you know, older members of this family, why did they do it? To me, I cannot talk about it without being emotionally moved, because just thinking about it, you know, you are facing death and somebody, you know, extends some helping hand to you is just unbelievable. They said, we didn't have any other choice. So it shows that Poland is not a homogenic society. All anti-Semites and all wonderful people. It's just like any country. It has these, but I would say overwhelmingly, during the war, the Jews were destined for death. And my mother was one of the lucky ones. And I think overall, if I can throw some statistics, I work at a university, so, you know, I deal with history of the Holocaust. You know, out of 3.3 million, 250,000 survived. But you have to be very cognizant that about 200,000 survived in former Soviet Union. So out of the 3.3 million, maybe 50, 60,000, including survivors from the concentration camp, survived on the former territory of Poland, which is a, I don't know, 3% or something. It's enormous, enormous loss. And so I hope I answered your question, but it's a complex one.
I'm curious why your family settled on Montreal. I mean, you know, at that time there was a large Jewish population in New York. Chicago had a lot of Jews. Was there something specific that drew you to Montreal and to Canada?
Yes. First of all, you know, my mother, as I mentioned, survived because of this Polish Christian. She was she had 8 siblings, and one of her brothers, Joseph, he also survived by running away east to the Soviet Union. He was, before the war, you know, a socialist. So, you know, it was a natural thing for him. So he came back in 1945. So out of 8 siblings and extended family, there were only those two. And, you know, he immigrated to Canada in 1956. So, you know, it was, we never wanted to go to Canada. You know, like Jews always kind of expect to be thrown out over the centuries. So there were waves of immigrations from Poland. And I remember, you know, in 1956, a lot of people left for Israel when they never, whenever they relaxed the, you know, very tight controls on the borders. And then to Australia, but, you know, we were kind of, you know, not planning anything. But in 68, when we had to pick a country, it was natural for us to go and, you know, and go to Canada because of my uncle. He had to vouch for us, you know. He had to, it was only like immediate family. And those who were thrown out of Poland, and we went to Vienna, and we waited there for 3 weeks, but we already had Canadian visas and this landed immigrant status. But those who didn't have family in the United States or in Canada, they went to Israel, you know. So for us, it was because my uncle already lived in Montreal, yeah. And he was able to bring us, you know.
How daunting was the prospect of having to learn French?
Oh, je parle français. Parlez-vous français aussi?
Oui, 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 un peu, un peu.
No, actually, no. When I came in 68, end of 68, it was, you know, pre this incredible push for bilingualism. So, I mean, I spoke English, actually. My parents kind of subconsciously thinking that we will have to leave one day. They forced me to take private English lessons, and I also had to speak Russian. I do speak Russian, so I have like 4, actually almost 5 languages. But, you know, so I spoke English. I went to England to kind of improve my English. So I was very fortunate. I was very fluent when I came. So I went to McGill I went to third year McGill immediately. Although I only finished one university, I kind of skipped two and went to third. But I was, again, very lucky because people who didn't speak English and they were already much more advanced, they just couldn't. I was just like ahead of everybody else. And, you know, at that time, I love French, but, you know, at that time in 68, this was just the beginning of this push for the Quebec, kind of bilingualism or even separation. So I did not have any pressure, although I spoke French and I still do, but everything was English. I went to McGill where I got, I went undergraduate and graduate to McGill University. And there was, you know, at the time, it was not a non-issue, you know. Actually, French people who came to McGill had to speak English. So afterwards, you know, it became an issue, but I work professionally, very large corporations, you know, based in Quebec, and I never had any pressure to speak French, although I would like to, but still, you know, so it was a non-issue, really.
There's some great footage of you in the film when you go and visit your old apartment. Right. The first time you got to see it after you had left, right. How much of an emotional experience was that for you?
Well, you know, it is actually filmed exactly. So it's like, you know, cinema vérité. And Swabek would not let me go in. He wanted to film it. And I just want to say I know from other filmmakers that Swabek is an incredible, his main kind of it is cinematography. So he filmed the whole thing himself. So when you see me going in, it is actually the first time I've seen it in 49 years. Yes. 50 years, sorry, because no, 2007, to the, yes, 50 years. It's first time. So I left it, I was 19 and I'm coming back. And, it's interesting because it's empty. The apartment is empty because, you know, as I said, this is like a condemned building. I know everything about this building now. And it's like, you know, turn 19th century building, you know, in Canada, it just, you know, wouldn't happen. But essentially, I was incredibly touched. And immediately, everything came back to me, you know, and as I say, it was my home. I mean, it was. I felt immediately the connection. It's very unusual for somebody from my generation and this immigration to be able to go into their own apartment because most of the time somebody lives there and they don't take very kindly if somebody comes, especially a Jewish person from abroad, because they are always concerned about, you know, but we were lucky to a degree that the apartment was empty. And you see me exactly how I walk in the movie. It is not staged. Swabek is very much filming this as it happens. And I immediately felt the connection. I recognize, and you know, the paint in the apartment, it is exactly our paint. You know, because I remember I now know who lived there after us. And they repainted the place kind of dark, but they had a very large object actually underneath where the painting hung. And what happened was that this big piece of wall is left. And this is what was my mother arranged to be painted maybe like 2 years before we left. And I remember that, you know, at that time, it was like somebody who comes in with the, you know, pails and a brush. And he recommended this color to us and this design. And, the, you know, it's unheard of in Canada, but the design is done with a kind of a roller. And then the wall is not just blank, like one color, but has this design. And I remember, because I witnessed it, when this painter said to my mom, pick this design because it's going to be totally lasting you for years. And here I am 50 years later, and it is there exactly as this guy said, you know, in really good shape. So everything was like very familiar. And despite, you know, this being a rather drab place, it was my home. Yes.
There's a couple of spots where, you know, there's the old fountain that you touch, or, you know, maybe you're touching the stairs, and you talked about how we live in such a visual society. But I'm mm-hmm. curious, when you placed your hand on these, you know, these relics, how did that enhance your already existing memories?
You know, it's interesting. You know, I basically wanted to absorb the details. And, you know, this happens to many people. We remember a lot from our, you know, younger years. I mean, I remember in details where everybody lived. I have many friends who left at the same time I did. And, you know, we are in touch, you know, so most of them live in New York, but they live all over the world. But nowadays, you know, we are very frequently in touch. And I can recount, you know, like events which happened, you know, over 50 years ago with incredible clarity. But, you know, all my years at McGill are sort of like a blur, you know. If you would ask me, what do you remember from your 4 years at McGill? I would kind of, you know, yes, I remember, you know, tension. I have no detailed recollection, but I remember everything from my childhood and, you know, young adulthood. And I just wanted to touch those things because the whole experience was unreal. I don't think it enhanced it. I was already overwhelmed by the whole thing. But at the same time, you know, I don't know if you read the production notes, but I think the person who wrote it really captured it, that, you know, in terms of memories, I mean, we do have digital memories. We do have, you know, nowadays especially, right? But still, you know, the touch and feel of real objects is like, that's what, you know, is the strongest memory, you know, and also it attests that this life really existed, that this is how it was. Digitally, you cannot recreate it unless you go there and see this in person and touch it. So it was just an enhancement to a very emotional, you know, experience for me.
You know, on that note of being still, then the film is called Still Life in Lutch, and this idea of the painting sort of being the catalyst, do you think it's in a way a metaphor for a specific memory or a specific time sort of being frozen in a way?
Well, you know, yes. I think what I was able to discover, and, you know, I had a great collaborator with this woman who runs the German department. One of the languages I don't speak is German. And she was able to discover a lot about who lived in this building before the war, during the war. And I think that basically, I think the movie is about the incredible emptiness left by Lodz Jews. I don't know, to me from the movie, and you know, I lived with it for so long, but the last scene, and I give kudos to, I don't know how you absorbed it, but the last scene, and especially the music, which was composed for the movie, it is original score, when it shows the empty apartment and the painting is on the wall back, and then the camera moves out and, you know, goes to that. It shows the emptiness left by you know, 200,000 people who disappeared without the trace. You know, not all of them, because, you know, 5,000 people survived the Lodz Ghetto. And what you probably notice on the last when Sławek shows my staircase and the camera pans to the outside, we discovered that the sons of this woman, who was the original owner of the painting, they did survive the war. And there's a family now of about 25, 28 people, you know, her grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great who lives in Israel and in United States. And I got in touch with them and showed them the movie. I mean, they were just completely overwhelmed. They knew nothing about it except for the fact, because, you know, some of these people had very interesting histories after the war, but they didn't know about the grandmother. I mean, she was a dentist, which was unbelievably courageous and rare for a Jewish woman for a pretty traditional background to become a dentist. And, you know, I'm in touch with them, and I show them anything we found, and we got a lot of documents. And then also there's another family who lived in the same building, and that one of the relatives lives in France. So I kind of was able to find those people and show them the film and show them the family histories. So, you know, like, it's like fragments, you know, like little tiny pieces. But overall, I think, to me, and again, you know, it's tough to me to judge the story, because, you know, I kind of, I felt, this is how I felt. But to me, it shows that not only the absence, of, because the Lodz Jews are gone, but Polish Jews, you know, it's like an incredible, you know, gap. There's abyss, you know. And I think Sławek was able to show it. And the way we use the painting, you write down, normally this is not a Holocaust movie, although we do have Holocaust footage, but you know, one of the people in the movie, Paul Seller, his mother was in the ghetto, and you know, he's looking for traces. And I even remember we found a picture of this woman on this empty street in the ghetto, and we were going to try to find out if perhaps it was his mother. There are some similarities, but it really doesn't matter, because it's like a trace. You know, again, he found out something, where she lived, what was her daily life, and so on. So overall, I think it's not only about Jews, it's about anybody, you know, any community which can be wiped out, and what remains. It depends what happens to the memories. And I wanted to bring a little bit of the memories, you know, back, that it existed, it happened, it was rich. It was really a rich life, not our maybe after the war, but before the war. It was a huge community with every type of institution. And this is what remains, which is very little.
You know, in the last 10 to 15 years, we've seen an increase in genealogy shows. You know, there's uh-huh. Who Do You Think You Are, there's Finding Your Roots. A lot of them, you know, end up finding Jewish roots. A lot of them end up finding Black roots. But what do you make of this, I guess, cultural moment we're in of everybody suddenly becoming really interested in their family lines?
Well, you know, I can only say, I think it's not my line. You know, I think one of the French philosophers said that the past is the present and the future. And, you know, it's for some might be easier, but the majority of people really at certain point in their lives want to know more where they came from. I think that, you know, when I lived in Poland, I wasn't preoccupied with this. I could have known this information like when I was living there, because the caretaker of this apartment building lived there before the war, during the war, and also after the war when we lived there. So all I needed to do was ask him, but I didn't care. It wasn't important. But there's a certain point in time, you know, it's sort of, especially if you have huge gaps. And, you know, I'm sure people of color, especially in United States, I still consider it a racist society. In Canada, you know, you have the Aboriginal people, you know. Anybody which had a discontinuity of sorts and their life today is impacted by the history would eventually want to go back and find out more. This is what happened to second generation Jewish survivors, you know, in Canada, thousands. You know, I have a friend of mine who lives actually in Vancouver, and, you know, like, it's the same story. Everybody wants to know because we never had family. So at least we want to find out that they existed and get some tangible proof of that. You know, I can only say for myself that, I don't know, about 10 years ago, I was in Warsaw and I was able to connect with a man who was already in his late 80s. And he came from the same town, my parents came, and knew my father. So I went to see him. He was very ill at the time, but nevertheless, he made time for me. And he told me that he knew my grandfather, you know, my father's father. I mean, you have no idea that when I left his apartment, I felt different. I felt grounded. I felt that I exist because I met somebody who, you know, can attest that my grandfather, Moshe Aaron Rosenbaum, lived and had 11 children, of which only one, my father, survived. So it's like grounding, you know, and especially for us, you know, anybody who in their family is second generation or third generation, we know very little. So at certain point, you want to find out more. And I think that's what is reverberating through anybody. It doesn't matter if they're Jewish or, you know, Afro-Americans or anybody. It's normal, I think.
You brought up not too long ago, you know, especially here in Canada, the Indigenous population. And yes. there's a clip of you in the movie. I think it's when you're talking about 51 Kielkasha Street. Right. With Roni, and
right.
you start saying out loud all the names of the
right.
people who had died.
Who lived there? Yes.
And it struck me that there was a similarity between what you were doing and what we're seeing now with, you know, the Say Her Name movement, or you know, that we say the names of the victims of, you know, police violence, or the victims of residential schools. I'm curious, do you see a relationship between, you know, what happened to the Jews and what we're seeing now and with certain segments of the population?
Well, you know, on a compassionate level, I really do. I think that I lived in Regina, Saskatchewan for 5 years. I'm not proud of it. It was really, I mean, suicide time. But I was working for the government at a very high level. I was like a Associate Deputy Minister of Economic Development, which was very interesting, but, you know, living in Regina, it's another story. And essentially, you know, I saw for the first time up close, you know, the life of on reservations, you know, because it's part of the government, I had access to this. And, you know, it was really an eye-opener, you know, horrible condition. I don't understand why this is happening when Canada has a Department of Affairs and there are billions of dollars going. But, you know, it was really a very disturbing kind of thing for me. But I have to draw one distinction. And, you know, I am actually working in my professional life. I do work with a very eminent, you know, scholar at Boston University, and his latest book is about the Holocaust and New World slavery. So now, as you know, slavery, the same as problems with the Aboriginals in Canada or here, even in the United States, reparation. But, you know, there's one distinction, you know. Jews as such were marked for murder. It was a racial policy which, you know, in Hitler, you know, and his henchmen idea that they were polluting the gene pool and had to be murdered in order for the race to survive. With all due respect, you know, I know there's a lot of crime going on in Aboriginal communities because of alcoholism. You know, I've read a report about women, Aboriginal women, you know, being murdered, you know, being victims of domestic violence, and comparing it to genocide. And I have to object to this because, you know, it is definitely a problem. But in terms of a world event, and I kind of talk professionally because I work on this type of scholarly works. What happened in the 30s in World War II to the Jewish population, there are other examples of genocide, like in Rwanda, where, you know, one ethnic group is really prosecuted because they do belong to this group, but the scale of it and the ferocity of it, the industrial approach to it is unique. So in other words, as the Black people in the United States, at certain point, even before emancipation, they could buy the freedom, it's called manumission, the Jews could not manumit it themselves because it came from the racial theory of blood purity. And I don't think the Aboriginal people in Canada, despite having enormous problems, and I really feel terribly for those women who were victimized, they are not marked for extinction. I don't think so. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the Department of Indian Affairs. And the same thing with slavery in the United States. It was a horrible thing, but they were brought to the new world, so to speak, to work. And there was the whole institution supporting, you know, buying of slaves. They needed them to be alive for certain periods of time in order to pay back the purchase price. It was a horrible system. But again, you know, it would be completely counterproductive if they were brought here just to be, you know, extinguished or exterminated. You know, it is a very complex issue, but I think I am very compassionate. I find that, you know, it is very much a gray area, and the word genocide nowadays is used very freely. We have a, you know, ecological genocide, and, you know, everything will be at one point named genocide. But what happened actually in Europe, in Nazi-occupied Europe, and the scale of it is very unique, you know, in terms of the history of the world. And, you know, you can have three people and it can be a genocide, and you can have 100,000 or 1 million and it's not. This is a massacre, it's mass murder, because it comes from a different idea. I know that this might be too academic, but there is a consensus about it. It's unfortunate. And I think that one has to bring some distinction. But as a human being, I feel very much a compassion. And especially after somebody who lived in Saskatchewan, I've seen it up close. And I feel terrible compassion. I feel compassion for the terrible conditions. You know, the Aboriginal people in Canada, not everybody. I mean, I met a lot of them. My husband's secretary was wonderful, and she was a Métis. I understand all about status. I mean, RCMP is based in Regina, you know. And if you have status, they want people who have status to join the ranks, and they do everything for them in order to have a representation. So it's not that they want them to, you know, like go away. Yes, of course, there are treaties which could be unfair, but this is not what, you know, Nazi policy in Europe was in the 40s.
This idea, I mean, not to belabor this point too much, but this idea of cultural genocide, which I think is another way of reframing it. You know, we had the vote recently in the government on the Uyghurs in China. We see what's happening in Myanmar with the Rohingyas. Is there a distinction between cultural genocide, you know, however sort of vague that is, and straight down the line genocide for you?
Right. Yes. You know, so in terms of genocide, you know, actually the word genocide was coined by a Polish Jewish lawyer, Rafael Lemkin, who was spirited out of Poland at the beginning of the war. But he was intrigued, you know, like he was a great lawyer. I mean, he was like an assistant DA in Warsaw before the war. So he had to be brilliant because, you know, he was a Jew and it was very open. So, you know, he kind of started to study governments and how governments really, never are prosecuted for murdering certain groups of people. And of course, Armenia comes to mind here, the Armenian, you know, what some people call genocide and other mass murder and so on. And he wrote many papers on this. And, you know, eventually he was the one who developed the Genocide Convention and lobbied the government, United Nations, and it was adopted by the United Nations in 1948. As purely based on physical genocide. In other words, you know, mass murder, extermination. But then the UN Convention was amended to include so-called cultural genocide. So in other words, you are destroying an ethnic group or a visible group, a distinguishable group, their tradition, their wealth, their language, everything. Yes, it is definitely a variation of the UN Convention, but as you can yourself perhaps, you know, also, confirm, it's not, the real genocide, the 1948 definition, the key to is intent, you know, intent to murder and wipe out. So, you know, when you have an intent to murder, then, you know, cultural genocide is basically irrelevant because, you know, you are just basically exterminating millions of people. But now, yes, there is definitely a cultural genocide is legitimized by United Nations, so-called, you know, additions to the original convention. And I think it is very valid and it happens in many cases, but you have to emphasize it's cultural. Yes, so you might suffer incredible, you know, deprivation, but you are not marked for murder, you know. When you think about, let's say, like when Germany was already completely ruined and unable to win the war after Americans, you know, joined and whatever, and they needed labor, you know, slave labor in order to, increase the plane production, whatever, weapons production. And people in the German government in at the very high level, I've read letters, correspondence, because I had to do it for my work. They were begging, you know, the people who were running the concentration camps to give them the, you know, emaciated, whatever, Jews to help them in the war effort. Himmler said, you don't understand. Those people are killing us. They are not pure. They have to go. And all these, you know, requests were refused, or they were granted on a very limited basis. So you send me 5,000, and when they die, send me another 5,000. But there was never a question of letting them live. While in the cultural genocide, you are allowed to live under duress, of course, but you are not necessary, you know, marked for extinction and total extermination. What do you think?
No, I think that's apt. You know, it's interesting because we talked about residential schools briefly, and at least in the media reports you read, that is much more termed cultural genocide than...
Yes.
Then what happened with the Holocaust, because they let the indigenous kids live, but they sort of they took away their their heritage, their culture, their freedoms, right? They're just like, you have to be, you have to be white, essentially, right? So
No question. And, you know, the same in the United States. I mean, I had the opportunity to travel through the South. You know, I used to go to Florida when I was in Canada, but just go to this kind of a really Southern states, you know, former slave states. And you know what? It's, I don't think much has changed. You know, you don't have to be educated there. You don't have to be like wealthy. All you have to do is be white to feel superior. And, you know, it is, you know, it was very, very eye-opening for me. So I would say, since Canada doesn't have a very large black, you know, population, I mean, you have some in Nova Scotia, right? The remnants of the Freedom Train who settled, you know, in the Maritimes. But you basically have some people from the islands. Like, I mean, in Montreal, you have the Haitian community, but nothing like here, right? But you have the Aboriginal problem, you know? And I totally, totally agree that you are not marked. Your life is just made miserable and is on a trajectory it shouldn't be, but you are still protected, you know? You are still part of the human race. So, and the same happened everywhere. If you compare it, the only thing you can think of that, yes, the slavery was like, I found out about slavery. For me, slavery as a generic name was terrible. But, you know, when you find out that basically when, you know, the commodity markets crashed and you couldn't sell more cotton or more tobacco, the slave owners started breeding slaves. In other words, they like breeding animals. I didn't know about this because I never delved into the history of slavery in the United States. But yes, you know, they basically had breeding farms. So in other words, they bred slaves for sale. And this is inhumane, brutal, and everything else, you can name it, but they were not going to kill them, you know? They were abused in many ways. So, you know, it's kind of a very tragic distinction, but it does exist. Sorry to bore you, but, you know, if you work with those things, you know, like my husband goes like, oh no, not again, you're gonna talk about slavery. But, you know, I was ignorant about it and I found out that it was one of the most brutal system, and it still impacts on American society. And you know, I lived here for 25 years, so I can see that.
You know, on a lighter note, you had mentioned at the top of this interview about when you lived in Lutch and the beautiful sort of city. And I've never been to Eastern Europe, but from what I've seen, you know, you look at Hungary, Romania, and Poland, specifically those three, I think, the architecture is absolutely stunning. You know, Italy is another one that comes to mind. Where do you think that comes from, and what is the most underrated thing you think about Poland?
Well, I think the most underrated thing about Poland is its culture. You know, there are Polish jokes, and those Polish jokes are always like kind of unkind, but they are based on you know, the kind of Poles, Americans or Canadians, no, people who came here, immigrated here at the turn of the century, who came from, you know, the great immigration happened. It was mostly economical. And these people, you know, left Poland, you know, 100 years ago and eventually had families here. But this is not real Poland. Poland is a highly cultured society. During the communist times, and I went to high school then, the program, you know, is incredibly broad in terms of education. I mean, you are kind of forced to go to the opera, and I say forced because I really don't like it to this day, but you know, you're getting a really very broad education. So when you graduate, like I know my husband went in Mont. He was born in Montreal, so he went to Northman High, and then to McGill. But he only took like 5 classes, and he wanted to take science classes, so he was like focused on this. In Europe, it's different. You have a very broad education, and it's much more kind of rounding. You know, you have astronomy. You know. You have no choice. You have to go through the curriculum. And, you know, those are very old societies, civilizations who existed for, you know, Poland. Jews lived in Poland for 1,000 years, for example. And Poland existed, you know, since before, you know, like there were pagans, but then, of course, they took the Christianity on. So, you know, when you talk about Europe, you're talking about thousands of years of civilization. And, you know, I think also values are different, you know, here values are different and there's only one denomination, at least in the United States, you know, you can be a boor, you can be uneducated, but as long as you make it financially, you are totally accepted. Well, in Europe, it's a little bit different. You know, you have to have the education, especially in UK, you have to belong, you have to go to, you know, it's a little bit maybe snobbish, but those countries place values on, at least when I lived there, it was very culturally rich. You really were aware, you know, maybe you didn't have access, but you knew the theory, you knew. And you know, they have great composers, great filmmakers. And all this was happening under communist times, you know, when we had no freedom. Interestingly, now it's worse because now they're emulating the horrible American pop culture. You know, so now it's not authentic. It's like kind of a pale copy of what we don't like here. But during communist times, you know, it was people were really very active in terms of creative because they had to be. They had an inner life and you know, friendships also are different in Europe. You know, here, I don't know. There's no such. I have friends I went to high school with. I still keep in touch and we see each other. And I think that friendship here is a little bit different because, you know, you can switch classes in high school. In Europe, you went with the same group of people from grade 1 to grade 11. But also, I would say it comes to values. So the big misconception, and I've been to Hungary and, you know, I haven't been to Romania, but I've been pretty much to Czech Republic and Russia, even in Russia. I mean, the level of culture in terms of arts, in terms of humanities is much higher than it is here. And because people had no other outlets, they kind of zeroed in on the heritage. So that's the biggest misconception. Everybody thinks Poland is a country of you know, uneducated kind of people who, you know, are not cultured. That's not true. You know, as a matter of fact, in terms even of, you know, at least when I was there, you know, it changes. Unfortunately, it changes for the worse. But it really is a European country, more so now when the borders are open. And, you know, with a rich heritage and culture, it's something which I think is much higher, you know, overall in Europe.
And I think, I don't know if this means anything to you, but this just popped into my head, you know, us both being Canadians, I'm sure we're at least mm-hmm. familiar with hockey, and Canadians might be interested to know that there was one very successful Polish ice hockey player, Mariusz Czerkawski, I believe his name was.
Mariusz Czerkawski, yes. I think he played for the Boston Bruins at one point.
I think he was. I think he was also with the New York Islanders, if I'm correct.
Right, Mariusz Czerkawski, yes, of course, yes.
Yes.
But Wayne Gretzky is of Polish extraction, you know?
Yeah.
Wayne Gretzky was in, he comes from Mississauga, right? Near
right.
Toronto.
Brampton, yeah.
And yes, right. I mean, he was, I don't know. I mean, I understand hockey. I don't understand football. But basically, I mean, his father was Polish extraction. His mother was Ukrainian. But yeah, but you know, he would, like, his ancestors came from those countries to escape Poland, primarily because of economic reasons. You know, it was impossible. But so Grodzki and Mariusz Trzykawski, yes, absolutely. But I would say that apart from the sports, and you know, like hockey is not that popular in Poland. It's mostly soccer. You know, the arts and culture, not everybody, you know, there are elites, of course, like everywhere, but I find it a little bit more accessible and of, you know, higher, very high, very high quality, very high.
And, you know, and speaking of Polish culture, the in Pierce Brosnan's first outing as James Bond, the main Bond girl was Polish born.
Was his wife, actually. This woman, yes, she was married to this hockey player. Yes. This right. Yeah.
Isabella Skorupko.
It's amazing. Yes, yes.
I know she grew up in mainly Sweden, but she was born in Białystok, I believe.
Białystok, yes. And she was married for a while to this Trzykawski. I think she lives in the States now. But yes, I mean, everybody who goes to Poland, and I had an opportunity to bring people for the first time, and, you know, people who either have some connection and others who don't, they are completely like overwhelmed, and the impressions changes 180% overall. And I witnessed that, you know, I was prepared to kind of hype it all the time, but they themselves just couldn't believe it, how different it is from the perception, you know, perception. So, yeah, I mean, I am never ashamed of my Polish heritage. I am Jewish, of course, but I have many friends in Poland and, of course, this incredible family, and my debt to them can never be repaid. So I am not typical of many people who only see bad things, but you know, there are bad things, of course, and mostly because of the current government, but the people are wonderful. And I just want to tell you one thing though, that, you know, you heard of this famous architect, Daniel Libeskind, of course, the one who rebuilt the World Trade Center. He's one of the greatest architects of our time. So Daniel was born in Łódź, like myself, and he went to my school a few years ahead of me. As a matter of fact, you know, when the movie premieres on March 12th, is opening here in US, on the 14th, we're gonna have a panel discussion and Daniel will join us to talk about Łódź, its architecture and what it means to him. And it's interesting that how his perception of Poland changed, because when he left in 56, you know, and I know him and I know his sister, we discussed it. He basically was happy to escape. They were leaving and they went to Israel and then to United States. So it's a different immigration. But then I just talked to him, I don't know, 2-3 days ago, and he told me how he changed his opinion about what Poland is. And as a matter of fact, he's very active. And in which, and this year, 2021, in which was designated as Daniel Libeskind year. He's really huge. I don't think he's built anything in Toronto, but you know, he's like the, as a matter of fact, he and Frank Gehry built things in Toronto. So Frank Gehry's parents are also from Łódź. So, you know, it's like amazing. Like, I mean, who would know about it? So we are looking forward to this panel with Daniel, because, you know, he wants to talk about it, that how important it is to him. But overall, I mean, when you saw the movie, did you know where Łódź was? Did you know anything about Łódź or Poland?
I mean, I'd heard of Łódź and that it was in Poland, you know, but I only because I'm a geography buff, but, you know, I didn't really know much. I mean, most of my knowledge of Poland came from Warsaw, from
Krakow,
from Auschwitz, you know, places like that. So I wasn't too familiar with the goings on of Łódź. I didn't know there was a Łódź ghetto, you know, although it shouldn't surprise me, you know.
It was educational for you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And can I ask you, did the movie resonate with you? I mean, as somebody who comes from a different background,
I guess for me, what it was, I guess, seeing how just raw everyone's emotions were even after 50 years, mm-hmm. I think that struck a chord, you know, just in terms of how vivid something can be after all that time.
Yes, and it's completely real, you know. So, you know, I don't know if this can be attributed to everybody, because this is a very specific story, but it was real. And, you know, people who participated traveled 3 times, you know, just to do this. And I have to say that we've shown it so far 3 or 4 times. And after, you know, people just, during the Q&A, so to speak, and, you know, those mostly are Jewish audiences, second generation of people or others, they want to know how they could find out more. And they always want to share the story. So it's been very gratifying because, you know, if you can get an emotional reaction from an audience, that's all we can hope for, you know. And, you know, so far, you know, we'll see how it goes now. But, you know, I was, you know, all this effort and, you know, the one never knows how it's going to come out. But it was gratifying to see that people were emotionally touched. That's what we can hope for.
Well, the film is Still Alive in Lutsch, and it is being released March the 12th on digital and on demand. Luca Ekbalm, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Dan. And again, my best to Canada. I still, at heart, I'm a Canadian. And, you know, good luck to you as well. And thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. You have a good day, and stay safe over there in New York.
Likewise. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. And once again, that was my conversation with Lilka Ekbalm, subject of the new documentary, Still Life in Lutsch, which will be released on March 12th. Be sure to subscribe to Endeavors on Apple, Spotify, Deezer, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can visit me on Instagram. It's sporadically updated at Endeavors Radio. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time. Bye for now.
I just like to have a lot of sex.